Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 89, towards curing malaria with Dr. Elizabeth Winzeller.
I believe that biotech.
This episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Ford, featuring Sync with My Ford Touch. Sync is the in-car communications, entertainment, and connectivity system that's voice-activated to keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
It's potentially one of the things that'll end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun's the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare it to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Every so often, especially towards the end of the year, we do a panel show where we bring in five or six PhDs. We talk about the best scientific papers of the year. And then what I do is I do that show in part so that I can go find out what the best papers are and then contact the authors and see if I can get them on the show. And that way we cover some really top science. Well, today it was kind of flipped. I asked a guest to come on the show, and lo and behold, she had a paper come out in Science yesterday or today. It depends if you, it's kind of dated yesterday. All right, which I consider probably going to be one of the most important papers of the year. And we'll provide a link to it. And it tackles, it's a huge quest to tackle malaria. And, you know, if there's ever a large feat that, you know, some personal endeavor, you know, somebody taking on that kind of personal endeavor, malaria affects, I think, between 250 and 500 million people per year. So it's a huge quest, a very difficult problem to tackle. But our guest is, you know, on track to tackle it, which is I think quite amazing. She is an associate professor of genetics at the Scripps Research Institute and the department head of cellular biology at the Genomics Institute of Novartis Research Foundation in San Diego. Our guest is Dr. Elizabeth Winzeller. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Mark.
We were talking a little bit before the show about some of your earlier projects, which were at the time also extremely ambitious. And, you know, we've even made reference to the project that we were talking about in an interview with Susan Lindquist, who was using the tools that you developed, which are pretty cool. So first, I guess I'd like to be able to introduce you to our audience, and so they get to know you, where you're from, how you got into science, and perhaps you could start with that. You know, you were mentioning that you know how to code, write code. So,
it's a long and winding road. So, I grew up in Reno, Nevada, and I was mostly an art major, or I guess as in high school, most of the time I just spent most of my time painting and things like that. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, except that I wanted to go someplace where it rained a lot, since it doesn't rain in Reno. And I was attracted to the Pacific Northwest, and I went up to Lewis and Clark College. And I studied art and did sculpture, but also being realistic about chances that artists have to make it in this life. I also got a degree in science, in natural sciences, thinking I might go to medical school. But mostly I was a sculpture student. And then after that, I was a bit lost and I wasn't really sure I wanted to go to medical school. And a friend of my parents invited me out to Washington, D.C. To write code for the government because she had heard that I was good at math. And this was back in the old days when we DOS and PCXTs and so forth. And I went and moved and programmed computers for the consumer, the housing component of the computer consumer price index for about a couple of years before I discovered that I really didn't want to spend my whole life sitting in a cube and I wanted to try some new things. So then I decided to go to graduate school. And since art was always my first love, I thought maybe I would try to pursue a master's of fine arts. And I applied to several schools and I was rejected. So after that disheartening experience, I decided that I would try perhaps maybe they would want me in science. And in fact, they did want me in science a bit more. So I started out initially by going back and getting a master's degree in biochemistry and biophysics at Oregon State. And then after having thought about different biological problems and so forth, I decided to transfer to Stanford University. And I went to the Department of Developmental Biology mostly because I was interested in how DNA is translated into a three-dimensional organism. And I started working on genetics with a woman named Lucy Shapiro, who works on Colobacter at Stanford. And then after that, I moved to the Department of Biochemistry to work with Ron Davis. And that's more where the story starts. So Ron was, this was in 1996, the yeast genome of Saccharomyces cerevisiae had just been sequenced. And when I had a conversation with Ron Davis, he said, and I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do since I've never been really sure what I wanted to do. And he said, Elizabeth, the yeast genome has just been sequenced, and I think there might be some opportunities there for you. And I said, well, there's a lot of people that work on yeast, and I'm not really sure I can make a difference. And he says, believe me, there's opportunities. And so I worked on yeast. And one of the projects was to create knockout strains for each of the genes in the yeast genome. We also did some of the original gene expression profiling experiments and developed methods for looking and discovering allelic variation in yeast. These papers have proven to be highly cited, I guess. But it was a lot of fun. And part of the reason that I was able to make a lot of differences is I was one of the few people in the laboratory at the time that actually knew how to write code. And so my job as a new postdoc in the lab was to write a series of Perl scripts to go through the newly minted genome sequence, pull out primers that could be used to amplify each of the genes in the genome, make a database where all the information could be served, serve this database to various collaborators throughout the world, and then also round people up. So, it turned out to be a good project.
Let me ask you about that. So this is at a time, I suppose, when, you know, the liquid handling robots are slowly coming onto the market. So you basically had to amplify every single gene of yeast and then do a disrupt each single gene. And there's, you said, 4,000 to 6,000.
There are about 6,000 genes, and it wasn't just me because we had assembled a consortium consisting mostly of former Ron Davis postdocs. And what we did was we synthesized all the primers using a 96-well oligonucleotide synthesizer that someone at the Genome Center had constructed. And then we made series of primers so that you could take a 96-well pipette min and then you could mix them together, and we would send out groups of 8 or 9 blocks of 96-well primers to the different consortium laboratories that included Mike Snyder, Mark Johnston, Jasper Rhine. And then the people in the remote laboratory would involve often an undergrad, as was the case at Yale with Mike Snyder. And this person would mix the primers together and do the knockouts, do tetra dissection to confirm the knockouts, do PCR, and then would ultimately send the strains back to us. And we would collate everything, put it into the freezers, and eventually this allowed us to create a collection of strains that's now been distributed across the world.
That's a lot of work. That's an enormous amount of work. How would somebody use this knockout library of genes in yeast?
So it's been really important for doing functional genomic studies. One of the things that we did on that with that collection is that we introduced a series of barcodes into each strain, and this allowed us to grow the yeast in bulk. So each individual knockout strain contained a little barcode that could be amplified using a pair of common primers. And therefore, we could grow the yeast in a flask and expose them to different drugs, and we could find out which yeast were more sensitive to a drug or a condition. And this allowed us to, for example, identify the complete set of genes that are involved, that are needed for, you know, growth in a high osmolarity medium or something like that. It can also be used to find drug targets. And the knockout strains have been used individually by many, many laboratories. Still being heavily used by, you know, groups, especially in Toronto. Charlie Boone, Gorgiever.
I guess if you have a drug that you're trying to determine if it has any kind of inherent toxicity to it, you could test it in the 4,000 strains and see if it has ends up with a profile of.
In particular, what people do, and we've done this ourselves, is that we made heterozygotes, so the yeast can exist with a single copy or with two copies of its genome, is a haploid or a diploid. And for essential genes, you can only knock out one of the two copies, and you can only do this in the diploid organism. And so it turns out that if you only have one copy of a particular drug target, it makes you ultra sensitive to a compound that's hitting that target. So, for example, dihydrofolate reductase, you're missing one of the two copies in a diploid strain, and you treat with a DHFR inhibitor, and that would make you grow slower than the neighboring yeast that has two copies. And by amplifying the barcodes from all of them and putting them on a microarray, or you could possibly do some sort of sequencing now, you can then find out which of the 6,000 or strains has an exceptional sensitivity to a particular drug, and this can be used to find drug targets.
Two elements of this project, right, that jump out at me. One, it's back in 1995, 96, 97. It's an enormously ambitious project, technically doable, very doable, but very technically challenging in terms of the scale. And then the fact that there's two kinds of science, right? There's discovery science, fishing experiments, and then there's a reductionist approach to dissecting a biological pathway or biological function. And are you particularly attracted to doing research that is discovery, large scale discovery, or do you? I mean, is that what attracted you to that project, and has that influenced your future work?
That sort of work was just emerging at the time, and we those of us who were attracted to this sort of work did get a lot of criticism in the beginning from the reductionists. I have sorts of scathing comments on grant applications. So starting when I was a postdoc, and just kept going. But I've always loved that sort of thing, and it was really fun to be in the laboratory at that time. At Stanford Biochemistry, it was right when microarrays were being developed. A lot of technology for doing high throughput discovery based research was coming out, and it was just an incredibly exciting time.
So I appreciate you doing this kind of more discovery science than the reductionist stuff, because when we're writing grants, if you can do it successfully, then we can all follow in your footsteps and say, look, other people are doing it, and it's leading to changes in society, beneficial changes to society. So keep at it. And that's one of the reasons why you're here, because I want to learn from you what you do and how to do it right. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about your current lab and what are the main focuses of your current lab?
So the reason I ended up down in San Diego was in 1999, when I was looking for a faculty position, Pete Schultz was setting up an institute that was partially funded by Novartis. And I'd gone around and interviewed at a number of spots in 1999, and I encountered many people who had reductionist ways of thinking. And I said, and they asked me what gene I wanted to work on. And I said, I don't want to work on one gene. I want to work on all genes. And then they kind of raised their eyebrows and said, that's not an appropriate project for an assistant professor. And you need to really focus down and figure out what problem you want to work on. And so I was slightly disheartened, but I went to talk to Pete Schultz, who I knew because he had collaborated with one of my collaborators, David Lockhart. And I told him, you know, I was looking for a job. And then he said, oh, you know what, we're going to set up a functional genomics institute. We're going to do discovery science, and we're going to build screening equipment, and we're going to have proteomics, and we're going to have sequencing, and we're going to put all of these really, really expensive tools together in one spot. And then we'll bring in other fairly junior people, and they can all share in these really expensive tools that they wouldn't normally get their hands on if they went off and became an assistant professor in their own little small space. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that sounded like a good opportunity, and because it allowed me to do what I was probably familiar with. And so I moved down to San Diego to join GNF. Was there about 3 months after it opened. And about a year after that, I started working. I obtained a joint appointment at the Scripps Research Institute. So we, for a real while, worked on Saccharomyces, but then I was given the opportunity to really set up a malaria lab at that time. And I had always been interested in malaria. I'd been interested in parasites and tropical diseases. My father's actually an anthropologist. I had spent time in Southeast Asia as a child, and Ron Davis, my postdoc advisor, had actually been involved in sequencing the malaria genome. And thus, when it became clear that I could recruit a postdoc that had a background in malaria, I thought, oh, this sounds really good. And of course, we have all these small molecules here, and we have this screening equipment. And one of the real advantages of doing genomics and functional and discovery-based research is that you don't actually have to have a hypothesis about what target is good or where you're going. And that's really good for organisms that are difficult to work on, like malaria. So I started building some chips. We started playing around with drug discovery, doing some bioinformatics, mostly because I knew that this was something that would be relatively easy to do. And then after a few years of practicing, we managed to get together a grant to do some of the drug discovery work with the equipment at GNF.
Before we get into the drug discovery, maybe you could tell us a little bit more about this work. Did you infect some model organisms and look at the changes in gene profile in the organisms, looking for potential targets, or just look for, maybe you could tell us about that first systems biology approach.
Yeah, so one of the first things that we did was to build an affymetrics array that basically tiled through the genome of the parasite that causes malaria. And that was created it was designed about the time the genome sequence was coming out. And the idea was that we could use this for annotating the genome. So the approach was to try to collect gene expression data from all different life cycle stages from inside the mosquito. I think you actually have a picture of the life cycle that you were going to show, maybe.
Maybe we could try to pull that up. That would be great. Liz? And there we go. Wow. That's okay. Page two. Second image. We need to go to the first one. This is an art, by the way, podcasting. All right, there we are. Wow. Okay, so I see a mosquito. It seems to be sitting on a leaf. No, it's on a person. Okay, maybe you could describe this for us.
So anyway, malaria is transmitted by the bite of an anopheline mosquito. The mosquito bites you, and when it bites you, it releases hundreds of sporozoites into your bloodstream, and they eventually migrate to the liver. And within the liver, they form these hepatocytes and eventually form liver schizonts. Some species of malaria, they can lie dormant for many years, but in most species, they remain quiescent for about a week or so. There's no symptoms, and then eventually they're released into the bloodstream. And once they get into the bloodstream, they invade red cells, they multiply very rapidly, and this is where you begin having symptomatic infections with malaria. So it's characterized by high fever, chills, you can go into a coma. It's fairly lethal without treatment, especially for small children or for people who are not immune, such as you or me. And eventually, maybe when the parasites begin to feel stressed, they decide that it's time to think about an exit strategy, and they form male and female gametocytes, which are fairly innocuous, but they circulate in the bloodstream. And when a mosquito bites you again and takes these up, they immediately differentiate into gametes, and they will mate with one another, or they will mate with what other type of mosquito, or with another parasite that might have been present at that time. I mean, another malaria parasite, obviously. Mm-hmm. And eventually, they form a zygote. You undergo meiosis at this time. The parasites are haploid up until this point. There's a brief diploid phase followed by meiotic reduction, and then this oocyte migrates across the midgut and then forms an oocyst. There's more DNA replication. You go back to a haploid genome at this point, and then the sporozoites are released from the oocyst, and they migrate to the salivary gland, where the cycle starts again. And wow.
We should have warned the audience. I think this is pretty scary. There's horror movies, and then there's malaria. This is okay. Sorry, I interrupted you, but this is. I'll encourage people to go to the website and follow the life cycle, because this complex life cycle introduces some complexity when it comes to doing drug discovery, right? If you're trying to make a vaccine, usually there's, a virus, and there's one shape of the virus. Sometimes it's slightly modified. Here you have a very complex life cycle. So how does that, what's the next step? You decided malaria.
We can go back to, initially what we were thinking of doing was, finding drugs or GPCRs or something like that. And
Let's pause for a second here. We're having some trouble with the audio and video.
Maybe, Elizabeth, I'm thinking about just calling you back, hanging up and calling back, because we've been having this more consistent. So maybe we'll just try to reboot it.
One thing you should do is definitely turn off any background apps. If you have mail that's open, or if you have Dropbox that's open, you might want to quit that. Any kind of web apps, just close them and they'll call you back.
Okay, I'll call you right back, Elizabeth.
Okay.
Thank you. Sorry about that. I suspect there's quite a few people at Scripps that are watching. We had some really hard times with a microbiologist from Princeton, Bonnie Bassler. Her video just was all over the place. It was very, very difficult. Although Scripps should have a good internet, they are busy at this time of day. Yeah, and this is the point where we release mosquitoes into the audience. I didn't think that was... I thought that was a good move from Bill Gates. I think it's one of his smartest moves. It's a problem that everybody has to... 500 million people have to suffer with malaria. And, no fault of their own, but no fault of humanity. This is a foe.
Thanks for calling Elizabeth back. I'm getting no answer.
Another try. She might be rebooting, but I don't think so. Sybil says, thanks for fulfilling my wish to hear about Plasmodia. this is an example of it's her. We're going to talk about her work on drug discovery, and it's a beautiful example of picking a disease and fixing it. And it kind of goes against traditional academic genetics or cell biology. Usually this is under the realm of translational science. People identify targets, drug targets, and they move it out. But she's, you know, sort of leading the way with respect to the academic side.
Okay, I pulled out the headset again. Right. Put it back in now.
So I've got no video. I hear you, but I've got no video.
No video?
Yeah, I've got no video of you right now.
It might take a second.
Oh. Oh, there we go. It's coming.
There you go.
There we go. Beautiful. All right, let's try it again, shall we? Okay. I'm just going to put this.
Hello?
Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Okay.
Great. We were talking about
Let me just put up a still so that Jeff can kind of just get a big visual of when... kind of they're getting back into it.
For those who have just tuned in, you're watching Futures in Biotech, and we're interviewing Dr. Elizabeth Winzeler, and we're talking about drug discovery and malaria, tackling a massive human foe. So where can we roll back the tape and so we were talking about picking malaria as a disorder. You explained the life cycle,
right?
And then where were we exactly?
We were talking about looking at different stages in the life cycle and looking at gene expression.
The complex life cycle,
right? And so when the genome was sequenced, one of the features that came out was that most of the genes were uncharacterized and no one had worked on them in any species. It was hard to annotate the genome. It was very, very AT rich. And the question is, what are all of these genes doing and what are their possible functions? And so the idea we had was to collect gene expression, was to collect RNA from as many different life cycle stages as possible that we showed you before, to collect them from these gametocytes, to collect them throughout the erythrocytic cycle, to collect them from mosquitoes if possible. And that we would make then a compendium of gene expression data. And the idea was that genes that were involved in similar processes, for example, in glycolysis or something like that, would all show coordinated up or down regulation within the life cycle. So we took RNA from all these different stages. We put it on this high-density microarray. And then we put it through massive clustering, and then we were actually able to show that, you know, that all the genes that we thought were involved in sexual development, most of them were coming up at the same time. Ones that we knew were involved in merozoite function were all coming up at the same time. And that allowed us to begin to predict what the function of many of the uncharacterized genes, especially if they showed really, really highly correlated expression with known genes. So that basically gave us a map, and from that, you know, we started playing around with different kinases and so forth that we thought might be interesting drug targets. So that's where we were about 5 years ago. However, one of the things that sort of came out with this is that, you know, there were a number of kinases that we thought would be interesting to work on. And we started to try to express them. And of course, there's always stories about how difficult malaria is to work on because of the really high recombinogenic AT content of the genome. People clone the genes and then they recombine with one another and they disappear. And then people are frustrated and it takes a long time. And at the same time, we're going, well, you know, we're not really going to do anything with any compound that hits a kinase unless it's going to hit the cell anyway. So why don't we just start by doing cellular screening and forget about this target, all these targets that we came up with. And so, of course, I don't like to take too many risks. So I did this sort of on the side. We started doing this on the side while we continued
guerrilla science, you know. Before you tell us about the guerrilla science of this side settler approach, I'd like to ask your opinion on using kinases as drug targets and their ability to actually get all the way through a drug development program. You know, kinases are sort of signaling, I mean, for the audience, they're signaling molecules that trigger, that activate pathways somewhat. They're the protein dip switches inside the cell that say, it's time now to divide. It's time now to undergo a form of metabolism or any housekeeping or differentiation. You know, there's all the biological processes. But the kinases themselves are fairly conserved and they're fairly closely related. And if you develop a drug towards one, you could affect not only what's under its control directly, but some of the downstream elements that might be tangential to the original biological process that you're trying to stop.
But yes.
I don't know. Am I wrong? What do you think?
Well, that's a concern. And I guess our thought was that with enough chemistry expertise, we could actually build out ones that were specific for malaria.
Okay.
But I think at the end of the day, what ended up happening was that the chemists we were working with were much more attracted to the compounds that came from a lot of our cellular hits and not so much for the ones that were hitting the kinases. And that's how sort of the program got started.
So however, I will say that... Cell hit. Sorry, we do have a 1 second lag. So because I'm in Cleveland, you're in Southern California, they're in Northern California. We have about a 1 second lag. So this is kind of like talking to someone on the moon. So if I interrupt, I apologize. I was just going to ask you, perhaps you could explain the term cellular hits.
Okay, so what I mean by cellular hit is that what we ended up going to do is just taking... So malaria parasites, you can culture them in the laboratory by just adding some human red blood cells that you get from a donor, and you can add your compound and some growth media, and you can incubate them all together in a really tiny microtiter format, 384 or 1536 well. Put them together for a couple days, and then you want to go find out which of the compounds actually blocked parasite growth and replication. And you do that by staining with the dye that binds the DNA of the parasite. Red blood cells don't have any DNA in them. They become enucleated if they're human. And then eventually the parasites do have DNA. So if they grow for a couple days, you can see an increase in the DNA content that can be detected with a dye called cybergreen or other DNA binding dyes. And thus, you can look for those compounds that block the parasite growth and development in the erythrocytes. And we were able to automate this whole process so that we could go through about 2 million compounds to find ones that were effective at blocking parasite growth and replication.
So you basically set up a cell-based miniature organism that's getting affected by malaria.
Right.
Single cells?
Well, it was looking at the replication of the malaria parasite in human erythrocytes, the natural host of the parasites in your bloodstream.
All right. Human red blood cells.
Right.
Okay. So you're now looking at infecting human red blood cells. So you're using one stage of the life cycle, the post-liver stage, Do you have to isolate the post-liver stage of the virus? Or not the virus, of the parasite?
Parasite?
Yeah.
You can keep that going continuously in culture by continuing to add fresh red cells. You have a flask. You get red cells from a donor. You take out the white cells. And then you as long as you continue to add fresh media and red cells, the parasites will grow indefinitely unless they get contaminated, which happens fairly frequently.
And then you have to do it 2 million times.
Well, the process of automation. So at GNF, and I really didn't have anything to do with this, but they set up a system where they made banks of chemical libraries. So all of the compounds that we were interested in had been arrayed in these towers. And one of the really cool things about working there at the time, and this sort of equipment is fairly commonplace nowadays, but I was around when they built this stuff in the beginning. And so we had some engineers from the Saturn car company build some of the robots, and the robots would come and pull these 1536 well plates out of the towers. They would stack them and do liquid dispensing very accurately. And so some of the screening that we originally did was run by hand, and some of it was automated. And my technician, David Plouffe, at the time had to actually, and several other people that were working on this had to actually physically transport several hundred plates, maybe several thousand, I can't remember. Anyway, from one screening machine to another to do the reading. And so it took altogether about 3 or 4 months, but it wasn't that bad.
For those that aren't familiar with high throughput screening, that means that a robot put in a drug on top of the cells, on top of the parasite. You treat them for a couple of hours to 24 hours for the parasite to grow. Was it 24 hours?
48. Well, 48. More like 72 hours. So that we had, it was actually 72 now that I think about it. So it allows the parasite to replicate several times, and it goes from one cell to 20 cells for each round of lysis of the red cell. So probably about 100-fold increase in the DNA. Yes, it kills the red cell, and which is why you have fevers when you get malaria and anemia.
We got a crazy lag. My apologies. You do 96 well plate, or did you do 384?
This was all done in 1536.
1536. So 1,500 test tubes equivalent in one single plate.
Right. One plate that's about, 2 by 4 centimeters, I guess. I mean, 3 by 4 inches.
Wow. And then you have, for 2 million, you probably have several thousand plates, right?
Yes, 1,500.
Each one of them had to be loaded
up onto a cart and wheeled across the room.
But you have to keep them all alive. I mean, these are fresh red blood cells. You can't waste them. You can't let them go.
So we did the dispensing with an automated liquid dispenser. We did the incubation, then we pulled them off, and then we put them back on again to do a lysis step. And I believe all of the plates eventually had to be read by hand. And so the various people that contributed to this project spent a long time pulling plates off and putting them onto the plate reader.
I'm going to ask you a question.
It wasn't me, okay.
Sure. Well, you thought of it. They all went, oh, no. So wait.
No, they were all fired up by this. I have a great technician.
I have someone in my lab doing a screen.
Who likes a challenge. You know, you tell him something that's too hard and that no one else can do it or wants to do it. And he says, show it to me, Elizabeth. So
I developed a screening assay for our work, and I have someone in the lab going through 200,000 compounds by hand. And I did my first graduate student HTS by tipping the boxes by hand on a 96 format, and then did the screening on my own purified enzyme, which I'd purify in the morning and then run about 5,000 compounds in the afternoon. But the lab saved money by having the graduate students tip their boxes by hand. We had a lab of 35 people, so to save money, we did that. Yeah. Saved about $17,000 a month. But so I'm going to ask you the question is, why go after the red blood cell stage if the infection's already imminent? Because the first part of the life cycle is the liver. And is that the best life stage to attack?
Well,
Before we answer it, I'd better read my spot. This podcast is sponsored by by Ford, so I'd better thank them, and then the answer life stage, among other things. So this episode of Futures in Biotech is brought to you by Ford, featuring Sync with My Ford Touch. Sync is the in-car communications, entertainment, and connectivity system that's voice-activated to help you keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. One of the great features of Sync is Sync Services. Sync Services give you audible turn-by-turn directions to where you want to go and displays directional arrows on screen, all without having to purchase an aftermarket or integrated navigation system. Sync Services also includes business search of over 40 million businesses, including telephone numbers, business information, and directions. A send to sync feature, which enables you to use Google Maps or MapQuest from your home or office computer to plan a trip. Then you can save it to your sync traffic directions and information systems account. Then you use voice commands in your vehicle to get turn-by-turn directions. There's a free sync destinations app, which gives you mobile access to manage your sync traffic directions and information systems account on the go, and the ability to pre-save destinations to your account, such as home or office. Plus, you can get traffic updates sent to your mobile phone via text message. It's all designed to keep your hands on the wheel and your eyes on the road. Ford, I'm my mouse, by the way, I'm using a Microsoft Office, and the scrolling is all the other way. So at least, you know, if I was driving a car with Ford Sync, I would just mention it. All with voice commands. So Ford Sync with My Ford Touch is available on the Ford 2012 Focus. So you can learn more about this and other technologies Ford is bringing to its vehicles at ford.com/technology. We thank them for supporting Futures in Biotech. Okay, so now's the question. Well, I guess it's kind of a tangential question, but why did you pick the red blood cell stage for your first HTS, high throughput screen?
The reason that we pick and everyone else picks the red blood cell stage is that's the one where you get the symptoms of malaria. So this is, if you can kill the red blood cell stages, you can make people feel better a lot quickly, more quickly. Mm-hmm. And the other stages are sort of icing on the cake, and they're more involved in eliminating malaria, preventing transmission of malaria, but, they don't, removing them doesn't necessarily make you feel better.
All right. Okay. So now you've got your screen set up. You're throwing compounds in, and this is David Plouf who's doing it.
David Plouf, right?
David Plouf, and so he's
it's the same walking. As Clinton's former or Obama's campaign manager, I think. So David Plouf, not the same person. Anyway, same name. Anyway, yeah, so he's walking them all back and forth, and you know, one of the other things that we have is after the data came out, you know, we have historical data for all of these different compounds that were screened, and we could look at the historical data and immediately flag those which had been active in other cellular assays that had been run on the same compound collection. So we could immediately find things that were specific to malaria parasites as well as ones that were broadly active and which we probably wouldn't want to develop because they'd probably be toxic.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, 48 to 72 hours of drug in the presence of, so you have this activity. Wouldn't 70, are you screening at like a fairly high concentration? And if you are, couldn't that just be toxic to the malaria and not to the red blood cell and be so in a non-specific way? You know, if you throw in poison.
Well, they were non-specific for they did in general. I mean, if you went really high, there could be things that were toxic to the red blood cell. But for the most part, the hits that we had clearly prevented replication of the parasite within the red cell. So they were just generally toxic to the parasite, not mm-hmm. to the red cell.
And then how do you take it to the next level? What's the next step you identify a hit? Where do you take it from there?
Well, that's where the consortium came in. We got involved. We're funded by the Medicines for Malaria Venture and the Wellcome Trust. We'd obtained a grant to create a public-private partnership that included the Novartis Institute for Tropical Diseases in Singapore, the Institute in San Diego, the Swiss Tropical Institute, the BPRC in the Netherlands. And we'd sort of assembled this group, and we put together a project portfolio. And the cellular screen became a major part of the project portfolio. So at that point, we brought some chemists on board, and they started looking at the compounds and looking at different compound families. And then they began to settle on several that looked interesting. The first one, product we ran first, is a bit of a test case. These are the spiroindolones. They were looking good right off the bat, fairly potent. They didn't require a lot of optimization. And those have actually progressed quite quickly in the drug discovery pipeline. And then we've had several other scaffold families that came from analyzing that collection of data. And we have recently began looking at which of those scaffold families are also active in the hepatic stages, which is the subject of the science article that was published yesterday.
So I'm looking at the paper that was – so you did a full screen, identified how many compounds in total, or structural classes, I guess – because you're going to have related cousins, right? Compound
right,
cousins.
Right. So in the initial screen, we had about 5,000 or 6,000 compounds that had reconfirmed activity of less than 1 micromolar. Mm-hmm. The ones that are about between 1 and 10 are sometimes – it's a little bit questionable, but there are about 600 scaffold classes within that. So you can cluster the different compounds. You look at their structures and you can cluster them based on their chemical similarity. And there were about using reasonable cutoffs. We estimated there were about 600 different scaffold classes. And so that gave us pre-existing SAR. One of the things that we could do is that we could say that there are, you know, 10 members of this scaffold class in the entire 2 million compound library. And we found 7 of them in our anti-malarial screen. And that gives us a high probability that this compound series is probably having something specific to do with malaria and might be worth looking at in more depth.
So if you have the same hit, then a hit that's a very close neighbor to it, where maybe there's a halogen that's added, right, halogen that's moved over by one position, has a hydroxyl group, functional groups on the drug. So this drug is binding to some protein in the malaria parasite,
right,
preventing its biological function, killing it. And then when you do your screen, you're looking at the 5,000 or 6,000 hits from 2 million, which is 0.25%. Those you have a lot of related structures, so you classify those into the 2-ringed, 3-ringed, 4-ringed, this position, that position, and then. But then, I guess, as you look at the potency for these closely related molecules, you can pull out something called a structure activity relationship based on where the functional groups are positioned. You can get an idea as to what is causing the better drugs to be better drugs.
Yes, it gives you some starting points, and then clearly the next step is to try to make these compounds much more drug-like, to make them suitable for putting into humans. And you know, I can't really take that much credit for this part of the experiment. This was mostly the team of chemists that worked on this at various points. But we were able to eventually create things that have drug-like properties. It allowed us to test them in animal models of malaria, and some of them look quite good. Some of them are being pursued in clinical trials. So we're really pleased, and we're really hoping that we're going to make an impact.
But was that from this? So you had 5,000 or 6,000 from the red blood cell screen, but then you ported it in this paper. You're reporting using a liver cell or a type of engineered liver cell, starting with a starting right. material with the drugs that were active on the red blood cell. So a double whammy. Were there
right.
any?
You know, one of the problems with having 5,000 or 6,000 hits is that this was actually a question that we got a lot. It's like, this is an embarrassment of riches. How are you ever going to decide which one of these scaffold families are most interesting and worthy of very expensive medicinal chemistry effort. And that's where we began to think about running additional screens, including liver assay, to try to prioritize scaffold families for further development.
And so you did find in these liver cells drugs that would hit, and
yes,
at extreme potency. Maybe you could explain the engineered liver cell.
So the liver assay is even more difficult than the blood stage assay, which was fairly simple, I must say. And the reason the liver stage assay was difficult is we had to find a source of infected mosquitoes, and we ended up getting them from the New York University Insectary, who sent us a cage, a biohazard suitcase each week, filled with mosquitoes that were infected with Plasmodium ewellii, which is a rodent model of malaria. It's actually not that dangerous for humans, but it does cause mouse malaria. And so we would get these mosquitoes and we would pull their heads off and we'd dissect their salivary glands out to get these sporozoites that are the things that are that transmit malaria. And these are the form of the parasite that will eventually invade the liver. And so we collected huge numbers of sporozoites. This was run over probably about a year. We dissected 5,000 or 6,000 mosquitoes, Stefan and David Plouffe. Again, and then they would put them onto now 384 well plates that contain these compounds that we knew were active in blood stages, and hepatocytes, and then the sporozoites. We'd incubate them together, and then eventually, what was challenging about this is only about 1% of the cells actually become infected with these sporozoites, and so you need to find these within the bottom of a microtiter plate. And the way that we ended up doing it is using high content imaging. So we would take a microscope camera, this was an Opera machine, and we would take about 100 images for each well in the microtiter plate. And we would use a computer script written by Gislon to go through and to try to find the schizonts within the sea of human hepatocytes. And then we would determine whether the compound affected the number of parasite schizonts as well as the size of the parasite schizonts. And what we found was that this imidazole piperazine family, that we also knew had good blood stage activity, was also giving us a number of hits in the liver stage assay, which suggested that it would also have additional activity against the liver stages. And that turned out, in fact, to be the case.
And you gave them to the rodents, and the rodents... first of all, the potency...
They weren't the screening hits, okay? So at the same time, we worked to optimize the potency against the blood stages. I didn't do that, but the chemistry group did. And to get rid of things that medicinal chemists know human bodies don't like, reducing toxicity and so forth.
And so
then the idea is to make them stable in the bloodstream for 6 or 7 hours so that, if something is cleared immediately from the bloodstream, it's not going to be able to stick around and kill your malaria. So they've modified these compounds and done a lot of chemistry on them to try to find which to create ones that would be sort of drug-like. And then those were put into the rodent models, and they did have pretty good activity.
In the version of the malaria that was given to this, these were human liver cells, HepG2 cells. Are those human liver cells?
If you express a CD81 marker on the human hepatocytes, they can be invaded by rodent parasites.
Wow. Okay, so you've got a rodent parasite. I mean, this is the beauty. Like, this is the beauty of the assay, I think. Well, one of the beauties is
you have to use. It's almost impossible to get your hands on human sporozoites because they're infectious. You have infectious mosquitoes. The mosquitoes can fly away. And there's only a couple of laboratories in the United States that actually have the ability to grow mosquitoes that are infected with falciparum malaria.
You have to do that in the Antarctic, where if the mosquitoes fly away, they die.
So you can imagine it might not be much of a problem. Well, I mean, people would get malaria and they just have no idea where it came from, right? And of course, you can treat it if people know you have malaria. But if you don't know you have malaria, sure. Then that's when, you know, it looks ugly.
So I'm just trying to get a grasp of this. So you've got your drugs that were pre-screened in the red blood cell assay. Then you're using a rodent version into these human cells, human cancer cells that are expressing a liver marker called CD81. And then you're infecting them with sporozoites that were isolated from the salivary glands of mosquitoes. That's painstaking. How there's a little mosquito. I guess there's some joy in that, right? Where you pick off the head of the mosquito.
There's a lot of on that paper. It was a team effort. Okay.
Yes, absolutely. There's
team science, big science. So.
And then you've got a drug. You narrow it down with medicinal chemistry. You improve the potency of that class of drugs, and then you give it to rodents that are infected. With a rodent version, and then you study the distribution of the drug, and then you start all the preclinical work on the rodent model. I'm looking at some of the numbers. For those that are going to read the paper in the audience, one of the things that's new to me that I'm going to be hitting the wall with when we get into our animal models is that you were giving, I don't know, 15 mgs per kilo dose. I mean, this is going to get technical, but this is for there's an audience out there for highly technical biotech stuff. So you give 15 mgs per kilo or 100 mgs per kilo as two different doses and track the presence of the drug in the liver. And at 15 mgs per kilo, you get 15.5 micromolar. And at 100 mgs per kilo, you get 193 micromolar, which seems like 193 micromolar. First of all, 100 mgs per kilo, if it was me, I would be taking over 10 grams of the drug. And then if there would be 193 micromolar, there would be, that's a very...
It concentrates
very
the liver, but I mean, it was 15 mgs per kg is not... or 15 micrograms is actually a fairly small dose.
Oh, it says milligrams per kilo.
It does. Oh, wait. Maybe we need to be checking the typos here.
Yeah, well, no, maybe. So it's 100 mgs per kilo would be a 10 gram for an adult male, 10 grams of drug, and 193 micromolar. 193 micromolar of any organic compound will destroy any cell. Well, maybe it's worth looking over. Otherwise, it shows a distribution in the liver, and I think that was the point of the paper, in a half-life of 7 to 9 hours. So the good thing about giving a drug is all drugs go to the liver, right? That's our liver's function, is to clear out drugs. So targeting, I guess, isn't that difficult an issue in terms of medicinal chemistry and distribution. That's what you do want. I guess that's also a benefit of developing a liver cancer drug, is that it's fairly easy to get the drug to the liver. So now you've succeeded in curing with a very double whammy drug, eliminating traces of malaria in the rodent model. At what point do you protect the intellectual property of this compound? That's always a question. If it's too early, then people can take your compound and derive it some more with some medicinal chemistry.
The chemists who've worked on this have protected their intellectual property. I'm not actually an inventor on it, but this has all been funded by public-private partnerships, and so you have to protect the intellectual property enough to give people incentives to develop it. But on the other hand, malaria drugs don't make any money, and I think there was a press release from Novartis about, you know, how many doses of Coartem, and that's a very effective blood stage drug that they actually give away per year to be distributed in countries where people might not be able to pay for anti-malarials. So, you protect the intellectual property of anti-malarial drugs, but no one's making any money on it.
I suppose one of the main difficulties of curing a disease is leveraging the intellectual property to raise the money for the expensive clinical trials. But I guess you could probably do inexpensive.
So we're not. So the people who will pay for the clinical trials, or who would like to pay for the clinical trials, are, you know, our foundations, such as the Medicines for Malaria Venture, which I believe is partially funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and other donors, the Wellcome Trust, and so.
It's kind of like an open source project.
Right. And I should note that as part of this, you know, one of the things that we did was to make the structures of all these compounds available so that people could do open source drug discovery. So that's for fantastic. Compounds that we decided not to work on, people in developing countries can take them up and try to work on them as well.
Especially since you were able to pull up how many structural classes in this paper from that hit both? I think 257 or something.
Yeah, that was so just compounds, not classes. But
oh, compounds. Okay, so there must be at least several dozen classes in there, though.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly worth following up. So there's you've not just created isolated one molecule that gets past an animal model, but you've created a whole pipeline of, if this one doesn't work, get to the next one, go to the next one, go to the next one, go to the next one.
Right, right.
And then really fight that medicinal chemistry.
And, we think that's hopefully spur in other places. Because, we recognize that not everyone has the access to these high throughput screening equipment that we have, particularly in, places where they're affected by malaria. And so we hope by creating, releasing the electronic data, we can spur drug development at other places.
Are you also making the cell line available? No, we had a little disconnect there with the Skype. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah, the cell line is actually, there are people that's we obtained that one on an MTA from the University of Paris at Dominique Mézière. Oh. So that wasn't our intellectual property there.
I think it's you should be very proud. Congratulations on the paper and to all the authors. I'll name Stephen Meister and David Plouffe as the first authors. Collaborated equally to the project, and all the way down the line, it was a stellar paper. And you're providing a whole infrastructure here for malaria research, and some very thought provoking approaches. I think one last thought I'd like to ask you in the industry. There's a strong desire to understand it now that we're doing 21st century biotech, to understand the mechanism of action, how that drug is binding to an exact protein down so that we can model the structure, the binding, and do it in a very safe, conventional way. And this approach is a cell-based assay whereby you may or may not know the target. What are your thoughts on target versus non-target drug discovery?
Okay. Well, it was, again, considered slightly heretical when we started this. But, in retrospect, it makes sense. Most of the anti-infectives, and I'm not saying that this is true for oncology compounds or diabetes or whatever, but most of the anti-infectives were historically identified in cell-based screens, and we can do them much more effectively now. And we also have tools to go back and actually find the target that weren't necessarily available. One of the things that we do very commonly with malaria these days, and which is partially described in the paper, is that we've developed ways of finding this, what often turns out to be the target, by slowly increasing the exposure of the parasite to one of these small molecules until they become semi-resistant. So this takes 3 or 4 months, and you ramp up the concentration of the drug, never giving it enough to kill it. So it's just, the sort of thing the doctor would tell you never to do with your antibiotic, which is to take it at sub-curative doses for 4 months, right? So you do that, and then after this, you clone your parasites. So you go down to a single cell again, and then you expand them, and then you sequence the parent that you started with, and you sequence the progeny that came out of the selection. And then you either compare the genome using microarrays, or you can compare them using whole genome next generation sequencing. We did both of these in the paper. And you ask, how did the genome change between when we started and when we ended after about 4 months of continual exposure to the drug? And what we found is that in many cases, what happens is it goes back to that yeast experiment I was talking about in terms of looking at haploinsufficiency, is the parasite seems to have acquired abilities to amplify the drug target. And it tries to escape the drug pressure by putting extra genomic copies of the target into the genome. And so we see sometimes we see copy number amplifications coming up about 50% of the time, and then we also sometimes get SNPs. And in many cases, these are the same genes, and this will often lead us into the target of the compound. And then you can go back and do more traditional target-based drug discovery.
See, this is where I learn. I'm going to do that. So you amplified PF-CARL as a gene.
Right, and so this was... We don't know for sure if it's a gene involved in resistance. It could possibly be the target, but it was the only gene that ever came up. And when we did this experiment, 26 million bases of genome sequence information, and typically we only have one or two, three, maybe four changes per genome. You do the selection in parallel three or four times, and if you keep getting the same gene, you know you've got a winner. And it's always different for different drugs.
I will recommend this paper to the audience, especially those in the life sciences. This is a really good, if you're interested in following the philosophy of pick a disease and fix it, this is a great paper for that. The paper is entitled Imaging of Plasmodium Liver Stages to Drive Next Generation Antimalarial Drug Discovery. So, thank you very much for coming on the show. This was, I appreciate you taking the time away from the science and to tell us about it and participate in, our education. So, thank you very much for coming on. Our guest today was Dr. Elizabeth.
Okay, thank you.
We do have like a 2 second lag now. Thank you. Our guest today was Dr. Elizabeth Winzeller, and she is Associate Professor of Genetics at the Scripps Research Institute and Department Head in the Department of Cellular Biology at the Genomics Institute of Novartis Research Foundation, of the Novartis Research Foundation in San Diego, California. Thank you very, very much for coming on.
Okay.
I'd also like to thank Liz Romero for handling the audio and video boards today and recording the show. And I'd also like to thank our chief twit, Leo Laporte, and his great team in Petaluma, California that make this possible. And I think the show is edited by Jeff Stewart and will be today. So thanks to his efforts as well. If you have any comments or suggestions, you can reach me at markmerc@twit.tv. Or on Twitter at Mark Pelletier, MarcPelletier. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.